From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, one of the questions that tends to annoy Ira Glass these days. What is the future of radio? Ira has called the question disturbingly nostalgic. Who cares if radio survives, he says. If it doesn't, something else will happen. And there are some problems doing a show like this. It can seem a little self-indulgent for obvious reasons. And getting to Ira's point, in an era of the internet and podcasts and hundreds of satellite channels, it's hard to say just what radio is anymore. But we're going to give it a shot. We're talking about radio today, how it's changing, the technical part and the content part, which raises this question: wherever it is you go looking for it, what exactly do you want to listen to? After the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's natural, if not a little navel-gazing, for those of us in radio to ask if radio is going to survive. Ira Glass, for one, thinks it's a nostalgic, boring question. He says we don't have to come to a judgment on it anyway because radio seems to be surviving in all its forms, at least right now. And there are a lot of forms that you could see as radio. There's the terrestrial radio station most of you are listening on right now. But there are podcasts, of course, and audio stories on the internet, and Ira says it's going to be fine. But what's it going to sound like in, say, 5 years? Aside from the changes in technology, how is the content in radio changing, if it is? And what exactly do people want out of the experience? Is that changing? We're talking about the future of radio today, and you could help us if you have questions or comments, your own radio habits. What is radio, do you figure? Are the days of terrestrial broadcast radio numbered? What do you, as a listener, want from radio? 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program is Bill Allred. He is one of the creators and hosts of Radio from Hell on X96, which has been on the air since 1986. He's been working in radio since 1980, and Bill Allred, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks, Doug.
Well, what do we mean by radio first? I guess that's the question. Has it come to be a different thing? I mean, how do we define the term? I guess I wanted to start there. How do you define the term, if you do?
Well, radio's always been essentially magic to me. Yeah. I have no idea how my voice goes from this microphone to various receiving devices around that. But I mean, that's what radio is. It's just waves out in the atmosphere that are being picked up.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
But then what is it more abstractly, I guess, we wouldn't want to talk about? I think radio is about the most personal broadcast medium that there can possibly be, and I thought about this a long time ago. I realized this a long time ago that it's more personal than television, because people listening to us right now, if they've never seen us, they've never seen Doug Fabrizio, and they've never seen Bill Allred, they create us in their own minds.
Yeah, they have an image of us.
Yeah, they may so our voices go out and they start piecing together bits of our personalities. You way less so than me, because of the nature of what we do.
Yeah,
and they start piecing together bits of our personalities, and then they create this image of what they think we are in their own mind, and it's very personal.
So it's a relationship.
Yeah, very personal relationship.
So it's based in some way on, certainly for you, I think that's what you meant mm-hmm. earlier. It's based on your personality. That's the clincher for people.
It's almost entirely that, I think. It's very commercial radio, I think. I mean, commercial radio is many things, but people use it less and less for music.
Right.
I mean, that's what it really was, and they use it now more for talk and personality and things like that.
But it's entertainment, right? I mean, that's essentially it too?
It should be all entertainment, yeah. I mean, I think even the most serious political talk shows are on a level, they're entertainment.
Right.
That's all they are. Rush Limbaugh is and Sean Hannity are not big political pundits. They're simply entertainers presenting a point of view.
When did you what made you go into radio? What was the thing that that interested you about the medium when you first jumped in?
Well, I basically got into radio because I needed a job at the time.
Huh, yeah.
And it's not what I intended to do with my life and my career, but it became that. I was intending to go back to New York and be an actor. That's what I'd been working on. I'd lived in New York. I'd studied theater and all of that. I needed a job, and I was in my hometown of Ogden, and a guy there who owned a little radio station in Ogden said, well, I need somebody to play tapes overnight and record the weather once an hour. Your voice can be on the weather once an hour. And I, well, whatever, it's a
something.
Job. Yeah. And it's better than working in a bar, which I had been doing. So, so radio became something more than that to me, of course. It became an outlet for my creativity, I think. I realized that.
Wait, because you took control of it? I mean, because you, as opposed to just going with what was happening at the time, you invented sketches and pieces and your own sort of persona?
Yeah, and I mean, that's a really interesting question. That opens up a whole idea of thought of really what I liked about radio. But at first, I was told to do it this way. Everybody does it this way.
Yeah.
This is the way you do radio. Yeah. You have to do this and this. You have to try not to vary outside of this because people don't want to know about you. I've been told so many times in my career, people aren't interested in your personal life. Just talk about the record that's coming up.
Right.
But you know, that's not true. That was just bull. And along with Carrie on the show, and we kept breaking away from that. And we say, no, I think, you know, people do want to hear us talk about our lives. And we seem to have been proven right because we've been successful at it. So, but anyway, it became an outlet for my creativity. I love doing theater. And essentially, I'm doing 4 hours of improv theater a morning, 5 days a week, which is great fun, and it's hard work.
Do you figure, Bill, the futures of public radio are different from the future of commercial radio? Or are they different in some way, do you think? I mean, as one who I know listens to public radio.
Yeah, I do.
A lot. So you understand how it's been changing over time.
I think
are they different?
I think the way public radio has been changing will make it – It's been kind of becoming like commercial radio. It's become personality oriented. I think the most successful shows on public radio now, they've always been Click and Clack, you know, those guys are, you know, they're personalities and entertainers. And I know they're done now, but people will listen to the reruns of that damn thing in perpetuity,
it's
I
true.
Think. You know, they'll just listen. Oh, it's like it's new to them every time. Wait, Don't Tell Me is very personality oriented. Peter Sagal has Ira Glass, yeah. Very personality. Yeah. And all of the pieces that they do are personality. You know, they come from a personality and you become.
They have a point of view. They have a perspective, a personal perspective.
And I think although do I understand Ira Glass is not, is This American Life going away?
No.
No,
it's not. They're changing a distributor. They're still working
all of that out.
And they do the podcast. I mean, this is sort of, which is a good actually segue into the fact that a couple of years ago you started a podcast separate from the work you're doing on X96. Why?
Well, several reasons. For radio to survive, commercial radio to survive, I think it has to be, and this is also true, I think, of public radio and why there are so many now. If you go look at podcast, there are so many public radio podcasts.
Yeah.
That, my God, you know, it's just amazing. I think you need to offer more of yourself on different platforms. You'll see the Radio from Hell show. We have a podcast the live show,
right,
so people can then get it later. I do my own podcast, The Let's Go Eat Show, which you can find at on iTunes and Stitcher or at theletsgoeatshow.com. Interviews with people like you were on the show.
Yeah.
We sit down over lunch and we just chat and I interview people. Started that because it's for people who, if they listen to the Radio from Hell show and they like me on the show, well, it's a way for them to get more of me and kind of the things I'm interested in.
But what's you? The interviewing?
Well, see,
the personality.
Yeah. Because I don't remember our interview specifically, but if you listen to the Let's Go Eat Show, it's me talking to the person, the men and women that I am interested in. But then I also am not afraid to let my own stories happen during the interview. Oh, that reminds me of when this happened to me too. And it's two friends or two people chatting and getting to know each other, and by doing that show, I hope that you get to know a little bit about Doug Fabrizio, although that was interesting to try and do. We could talk about that if you want. and you also get to know a little bit more about me as well. So that's why we do it.
One thing you said that I find interesting is you've talked about the live element, how the live element of radio, you know, which is not going on obviously in the podcast, but what is going on with Radio from Hell. That's something you can't get on a podcast, a sense that something's happening right now. You feel like that's part of the draw for
people? I think it is, yeah. And
I think they're there right now. They're talking about this thing right now.
Yeah, people – and it is – and it's there's a certain amount of danger to it because who knows what I may say that could get me in trouble or you know, that's a
mistake.
You
like that part? You like that danger part?
I do. And and I always kind of push it a little bit, try to push it a little bit and say, well, I wonder if I can get away with saying that. And so far I've done okay. I haven't been fined by the FCC or I've been reprimanded by my employers on occasion, but not horrible, you know. So I think there's that element of danger. And even on your show, Radio West, a much more controlled atmosphere.
Yeah, much.
But you don't have. Do you have a kill? Do you have a mute switch here? Do you have a kill switch? If I accidentally swore or, you know, said
no.
Yeah. See,
I don't.
It's there.
Yeah.
That element of danger is there, even though
we've been caught a few times, by the way, by that.
Yeah, I would imagine somebody says, and
yeah,
yeah, and you just you go, and what do you do as the host? You go, oh boy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, at least it was, and you can say it was not I that said it. It was the guest, you know. And I think you stand on firm ground with that. But so I love that element of it too.
What are you listening to? Do you listen to a lot of radio?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
I drive around and I listen to. I have on my car probably a lot KSL, believe it or not, mm-hmm. or as I like to call it, K Salt Lake. And
why?
Just,
why?
I don't know. Just to be rude.
No, I mean, why do you listen to KSL?
Oh, why do I listen?
I mean,
because I like to yell at how awful I think it is, and I listen to it because I will get some news that's of the moment. I'll get some news, and then I'll listen to some of their other shows, and I just yell at them because I think they're not very good. And I see, I love bad radio too.
Yeah.
When I go to little towns on road trips, my wife says, how can you listen to this? You know, I'll search around for little small town radio, and there's still so few of them left, but, you know, small town radio people doing tradio and things like that. I love that stuff.
Yeah, preachers. And
yeah, all of that. I'll listen to AM. I listen to KSL on AM just to be perverse about it.
Do you think that the internet has changed what people want out of the experience of radio? You know, access to videos and short docs and podcasts. Has that changed what they want out of the experience?
Sure, and you know it has. That's why you do Video West. You want other. There are other platforms that people want from you.
To experience
the story. To experience, yeah. There are other ways. I mean, soon you'll see not only is there a Radio from Hell podcast, but there'll be Radio from Hell on probably live streaming. You'll be able to watch the entire show if you want. I'm not sure why you would, but it's and we'll probably do things to cater to that when that. Like right now, we just have one crappy little camera in the studio, and we don't do much with it. But that's about to change. We're going high tech. There'll be cameras that we can switch back and forth in the studio, and we will do things to cater to that as well. A video element. You'll see more and more videos coming from us that will go up on our website.
But that says what? That people, because in this. This digital era, they want to see something too.
Yeah.
And not just hear it.
Yeah. And that's, well, I think that's how the internet has changed things. I don't think they necessarily want to see things, not just hear it. It's just another option.
Yeah.
Radio.
And that's what it's about.
Yeah.
Options.
It's just options. The internet has blown apart so many things. People have so many options, and they want more. So we'll work our butts off to give them more options, more ways to experience us.
But in the end, do you figure it comes down to sort of where we started in this conversation? That is, it's a disembodied voice that we create our own image mm-hmm. of, our own relationship to. Mm-hmm. And in the end, do you think... Does that give you a sense that this form, at least in the way most people are listening right now, will survive because of that basic element?
It will survive because of that basic element and because it is for the masses.
Yeah.
It is – it's cheap. It's free. I mean, it's free. It's free entertainment, and everybody can have it. Everybody can have it. You don't have to have a computer.
Yeah.
You don't have to have something to watch it. It's out there and it's free and it's flowing out into the ozone, and all you got to do is have an inexpensive little box to pick it up.
And this is how most people are. I mean, you know, people talk a lot about podcasts, but right now this is how most people are experiencing radio.
Sure.
Right?
Adam Carolla has made a good stab at making podcasts more mass appeal, but it's still a podcast, and if a big radio station in LA or a syndicator came to Adam Carolla and said, what do you say we simulcast your podcast and do it 6 to 10 in the morning, he'd say, you bet, because more people would hear it. Way more people would hear it.
It's Bill Allred, host of Radio from Hell. Stick around if you would.
Sure.
On radio station X96, along with Carrie and Gina, and we'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of radio, whatever that means. What's it going to sound like in, say, 5 years? Aside from the changes in technology, how is the content in radio changing, if it is? We have some radio people with us today to talk about the future of radio. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Nick Vanderkolk. He is creator and producer of the podcast Love and Radio. He's also served as a producer of the NPR program Snap Judgment. He's joining us today from member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. And Nick Vanderkolk, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to start in the same way I did before with Bill Allred, and that is, what is radio, at least the way you think about it, at least the part of radio that drew you to it at first?
Well, it's funny because I really cut my teeth in podcasting. I graduated college in 2005, and that was basically the first year, that first full year that podcasting existed.
Yeah.
But I always sort of identified myself much more as a radio person.
Hmm. Why?
I think because,
yeah.
Well, I think especially in those early days, there was this promise of podcasting sort of breaking everything apart, and people were very excited about it. I think we're sort of in the second wave of that kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened in that first wave is as everyone sort of got on board and started making their own podcasts, and most of them were pretty terrible.
Right, right.
And the stuff that always inspired me, at least in those early days, was more radio programming. And initially, the first podcasts that I listened to were radio programs that were turned into podcasts. So I always sort of and even now I still have this like weird embarrassment when if I'm at a party and someone says, "Oh, this is Nick. He does a podcast." I feel like I have to say, "No, but no, people actually they like it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And people listen."
Yeah. Well, like saying I'm a mommy blogger or something like that.
Right. Right. Right, exactly.
Yeah. What's the
Let me ask you this.
What's the fundamental difference between a podcast and radio? It seems like in some way you're saying there's not – I mean, one of the things we were talking about with Bill earlier is radio is live. There's a serendipitous kind of quality to it. You called it, Nick, a funny roulette wheel that you don't quite mm-hmm. know what you'll get. And I guess that's an important distinction, right?
Yeah, and I do really like that aspect of it. I mean, I think there are advantages and disadvantages to both. I mean, I think – You know, I used to be of the opinion that radio, that anything that was good as a podcast made for good radio.
Yeah.
And I didn't really see much of a distinction between the two. But I think, you know, I came to understand that at least in the work that I was doing, I was really, whether consciously or subconsciously, trying to take full advantage of the peculiarities of podcasting, namely that people are choosing to listen. They're choosing to listen from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really have any kind of format issues. But I think being able to have people from start to finish and to be able to sort of craft a story or a more abstract narrative arc,
mm-hmm.
It gives you way more leeway to do that. You know, you don't have to kind of constantly sort of reset the conversation. You can really take people in sort of more of a journey.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I realize that sounds totally pretentious, but
but it's about a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? It's a basic story form.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm trying to figure out ways to sort of break down that kind of arc.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think in general, you do want the story or the narrative or the interview to kind of unfold in a way.
I wanted to sort of explain one of these ways in which you seem to be breaking down the conventional of idea of a story arc. And one of them is the way that we think about a story having to have a character in a story. We have to relate to it. And you've talked about how you have a bit of ambivalence about that. You want people to feel like maybe they're not exactly. It's impossible to relate to a particular character or a particular situation. I mean, you've talked about how you like it when people, I guess, kind of squirm or feel uncomfortable in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get the question a lot. Why is the show good despite that we often feature characters that they find unlikable?
Yeah.
And I'm always very annoyed by that question because, A, I personally – I find everyone on some level, everyone that we've featured on the show, I find likable to a certain degree. I can empathize with their situation. I'm mostly interested in stories, though, that where I'm not actually sure how I feel about what someone's done,
mm-hmm.
and the show itself becomes a way of trying to understand that, and I think that the whole question of likability, like I would never get that question if you know I was the creator of Breaking Bad or something like that, and I don't know what it is about about radio or audio in particular that makes us feel like we can't be comfortable with, you know, ambiguity and ambivalence. And I mean, in terms of like, I mean, the broader question of like, what is the future of radio? My hope is that we will become more comfortable with a lot of that kind of ambiguity.
Yeah. I guess the question
I mean, not to to pounce on Ira too much because he's obviously, you know, a great influence and has done a lot of great stuff. But one thing he has said on a number of occasions is that radio is a didactic medium.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's always necessarily the case.
But Ira's also the one who says for it to work, it has to be a relatable character. Whatever he means by that. I mean, that is, you know, he has these kind of this list of characteristics that have that for his show anyway, and that's one of them, that it has to, not that he has to be likable, but we have to relate to it in some way. And that sounds like you're sort of less interested in, is that what you mean by the ambivalence? You don't really care if we relate to it. I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to showcase someone who I think is just sort of bonkers, you know.
Yeah.
And so I guess I agree with that statement that you need to be able to relate, but maybe I just relate to a weirder set of
people
right? than Ira Glass does.
I want to play some tape because I want you to I want to get to this question of who's doing it well, at least as you see it, who's good at it, and what's rising to the top in terms of podcasting/radio, whatever we mean by that. But I want to start with your show. Love and Radio, and there's a piece called Thunderbolt. It's called The Wisdom of Jay Thunderbolt, an episode that we actually played an excerpt of this several years ago. It won the Gold Award for Best Documentary at the Third Coast Audio International Audio Festival a few years ago, and it gives you a sense of the way you are putting stories together in terms of the way you are using sound and music and manipulating it all. Talk about this as an example of the kind of work that appeals to you, and we'll get to this question of whether this kind of work's being done. But talk about this particular piece because I want to give people a sense of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, one of the things that I think is there's going to be a lot more of in terms of radio production is a more sort of hands-on musical element. I work very closely with another producer on the show named Brendan Baker, who studied composition. And so he comes at storytelling from a much more musical perspective. And he does a lot of the sound design for Love and Radio. And this is actually an excerpt of our very first collaboration that we did together. Hopefully you'll see it's a much more obvious example of kind of where music and storytelling and characters can kind of cohere into a single thing.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a clip. This is Jay Thunderbolt telling a story about his childhood dog, Abraham.
Back in the day, mixed Labrador Doberman. His name was Abraham. The great thing about Abraham was he was a big boy. Used to be a butcher shop at the corner. Abraham used to get the bone. He'd chew that bone in 2 days. The great thing about Abraham was, inside, nicest dog in the world. Unless you try to come too close to my mother. My uncle would come over, he'd lick all the aftershave off. But then when my uncle went to go give my mom a hug, Abraham would lean up against my Uncle Jim and go, "Arr." He was extremely protective.
You know, one of the things I think is interesting about that piece is, I have to say, as I was coming up in radio, I was hearing stories like that, or at least experimentation like that on the radio all the time. I mean, you had Jay Allison, you had Larry Massett, you had Barrett Golding, you had Scott Carrier, who's going to be a guest on the program coming up here in a few moments. people really testing the form. But this is one of the things you've talked about, and we'll talk about it a little bit more when we get Scott in here in a moment. But that is – NPR was given to – and NPR was like one of the only sources back in the day. There are more options now, which we can talk about. But it was more given to experimentation, it seems. And then they sort of stopped doing that for a while. So it seems like, I guess, you stopped hearing these kinds of stories.
They were running out of money.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Which says what?
Well, I'm sure Scott can talk more about that.
Yeah,
but I mean, certainly, yeah. I mean, I think in the early days of public radio, people didn't really know what it was supposed to sound like. And so they were kind of throwing a million different things at the wall to see what stuck. You know, some of it didn't sound good. Some of it sounded great, and sounded super unique and interesting. And I think, you know, in order to, I don't know, for financial reasons or whatever, you know, they adopted a much more conservative sound.
Yeah.
And I totally get that. I get why that's important if you're running a business. But I do think that if you're not willing to take the risks of trying out new forms that might sound totally bizarre to people, then you're not really going to get anywhere. And I think that's why radio, you know, I love it dearly, but it's not the most innovative of mediums.
Hmm. So I guess what you're saying in some ways is – podcasts, that's where people are feel – that's the sandbox. That's the term you've used. That's where people feel more free to kind of experiment, podcasts, not radio like it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly hope so. That's what it's been for me, for sure.
I wanted to ask you, one of the things you've talked about, how you know, when we talk about radio, I mean, you know, we were talking to Bill about commercial radio. That's a form. We're talking to you about public radio, whatever that means. That's a form. Is that part of the future of radio? These kind of cultural niches, we get more and more fragmented, finding these subsets of. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But are you seeing more of that?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's happening. I think that's happening everywhere. I mean,
right.
With cable television. I mean, just the number of options has just gotten so enormous that the culture is essentially fragmenting. And I think that's totally happening to radio as well. I mean, in some ways it's great. It's been great for me because I can find my little particular niche. You know, one thing when I'm, you know, when I've pitched the show or episodes to various radio stations, you know, a lot of them are really concerned about sort of like the adult content that that appears in a lot of the podcast, and are worried that people would complain and stuff. And I've been doing that show off and on for about 8 years now. I just got my very first adult content complaint about 2 weeks ago, and I mean, part of that is, you know, obviously the audience is smaller, but I think that also is just because people are self-selecting. Like, they know what they're going to get.
Yeah.
You know, they're not sort of randomly turning on the radio and you know, hearing this thing that they don't want their kids to hear.
What are you listening to? What's rising to the top for you these days?
Well, at the risk of being totally self-promoting, I mean, I listen to all of the shows on the Radiotopia label. Of which Love and Radio is a part. That includes 99% Invisible, mm-hmm. with Roman Mars, Theory of Everything, The Truth, Strangers, The Kitchen Sisters, and Radio Diaries. Radiotopia is essentially almost like an indie music label for podcasts. Honestly, like I think that they're experimenting with a model that's going to you're going to see a lot more of, essentially these podcast networks that come together and give people enough support to actually produce what they need to produce, but also have like the creative control over the product that they can try out new things.
Financially viable, you think, in the future?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, I mean, podcasts, the podcast audience, as Bill mentioned, the podcast audience is much smaller, but it is growing a lot faster. And I think if you know, various podcasts sort of band together to, you know, for advertisers or help with fundraising and stuff like that, I think that's the way that you can make it a viable business model. That's the bet that I'm making anyway.
And you're sticking to it. Nick Van Der Kolk is with us. He's creator and producer of the podcast Love and Radio. Nick, stick around with us. Can you?
Yeah, I'm happy to.
We will take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. Okay, we are. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of radio, whatever that means. We've been talking to Bill Allred, one of the creators and hosts of the Radio from Hell program on the commercial radio station X96. Nick Van Der Kolk, also with us, creator and producer of the podcast Love and Radio. It's part of the umbrella radio program, Radiotopia. And we'll put a link to it, by the way, on our website so you can check that out. There's a lot of amazing radio going on there. And now we have with us Scott Carrier, longtime radio producer whose work has appeared on all kinds of programs. This American Life, of course. That's how a lot of us came to know it. Actually, I came to know it through All Things Considered. I worked with you. That's a long story. Yeah. He's a professor of journalism at Utah Valley University, and welcome back.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be here.
So I always got the sense that a couple of years ago, really not that long ago, you felt kind of hopeless about radio. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yeah, that is fair to say because it seemed like the opportunities were closing down, and the government, the CPB, stopped giving funds to independent producers. And that's how a lot of us survived. That kind of dried up about 2003. Not entirely, but it got cut way back. And so we couldn't figure out any other way to make money, really.
I know you've told the story what some of your students would come to you and say, hey, I really want to get into radio.
Yeah, and I'd tell them, no,
don't
do it, unless you can't do anything else.
Right.
If you can't do anything else, it's great. But, I just didn't think it was good advice to tell them to do that. And I've been teaching down at UVU for about 6 years, and I never taught a radio class of my own anyway.
Yeah,
down there, because I just didn't think it was viable option, but I think podcasting is going to change that.
You're feeling differently about it because of that?
I think so. Because there's an audience.
Yeah.
There's a demand for podcasts, and the audience is really easy to see. I think advertisers or marketers could pinpoint the demographic, and that they could sell that. It's young people in their 20s and 30s, you know, well-educated, perhaps underemployed or unemployed, but I think that these young people, the way they listen to podcasts and the way they talk about it and pay attention to podcasts is different than the way people used to talk about public radio, for instance.
And what do you mean?
Well, they're more enthusiastic, and I think that they feel like they're involved in it more, that they have some right to be even more critical than they used to be.
Really?
Like, this is what I like, this is what I don't like, not in a critical in a bad way.
No, right.
You know, they're very enthusiastic about what they like, and they talk about it, and it's like there's more of an involvement there than there used to be. They feel like they're a part of it.
Right.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And so I think that not that long, maybe next year, there'll be podcasts that have, you know, sponsorships. And already, Nick, I was going to ask you about the sponsors for Radiotopia. How that works, the business model, because you said before it is a new model that might work. It was like an indie record label. I think that's what it looks like to me. And so I'm excited about it that you guys banded together and are raising money and are getting paid, I guess, a little bit anyway. How does it work?
Yeah.
How does the money, revenue part work?
I don't know how much they want me to go into like breaking down the details, but I mean, they deal with all of the sort of underwriting aspect, which for me is great because I just want to just focus on producing the show, you know. I don't want to be chasing down underwriters and things like that.
So you don't know?
Oh, I mean, I know a little bit. We'll talk off the air.
Yeah. Well, I get the broader question, though. Let me go back to something Scott was mentioning, right. This idea of enthusiasm that there are – I guess in some way, Scott, you were thinking, I don't think there's an audience for the stuff that I was doing in the past. And now you're saying that I think there is, right?
Yeah, I've always felt like there was an audience for my stories because people come up and talk to
it's true.
Tell me about it. But I was just having a hard time getting my stories on the air more and more.
Yeah.
Because the shows that were around were being more and more careful about the content that they'd play. And it just seemed like the stuff I was interested in wasn't really going to make it. Like Nick's work, which I like a lot, Love and Radio, but he plays stuff that, you know, would never make it on NPR. It just they would even feel insulted that he asked them, I would imagine.
Do you think that's right, Nick?
Well, hopefully not the insult part, but
Well, if you tried to play the Jay Thunderbolt story on
All Things Considered,
they would be upset, even that you asked.
But it's funny. I mean, I remember, Scott, you've told me this story before. There was a sort of this turning point, it seems like, in public radio, or at least in NPR. And it was – I remember
– Yeah, I saw it. I was there in 1983. They ran into a financial problem where they were $9 million in debt, and which doesn't sound like a lot, but to them it was a lot at that time. And they reacted by firing 33% of the staff and made some changes. Instead of being like this place for creative work and pursuing creative new ways to do radio, which is how it started in the beginning – they decided to become a reputable news organization. And they didn't think that the two could go together. And the best example of that, I think I can tell this story in a short period, is Larry Massett's story, A Trip to the Dentist, which starts as a standard documentary. And so my teeth hurt. My friend said, I have a good dentist. You should go see him. And so he goes to the dentist, and you hear the dentist, you hear the nurses and the drill and things like that. But then the dentist gives him nitrous oxide, and he starts hallucinating. In the middle of this story that was like a realistic documentary, it all of a sudden becomes surreal. And you hear the African drums and this old woman telling some story, and it's just a wild mix for about 3 minutes. And then you hear the drill again and the dentist, and it comes back to realism. And this, you know, his teeth are fixed. He leaves the dentist's office. That's the end of the story. But the switch from realism to surrealism and then back to realism, just Robert Siegel said at a conference, I was there, he said, we won't be playing Larry Massett's Trip to the Dentist anymore. Even though they did, after he said that, they played it again. They did. That's the kind of thing that they didn't think, and they still don't think, that they can switch back and forth. If other people want to do stories like that, sort of experimental or new types of stories, they can do it, but we're not going to do that here. I think that's their attitude. I shouldn't be putting words in their mouth, but that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
So NPR changed at that time. They got a lot more news heavy, and the creative people were pretty much, over a period of time, pushed out or fired or, you know.
You figure now, though, with what Nick's talking about related to the kind of the freedom about podcasts. What do you think about your own work? Do you sense that there might be a resurgence for your own stuff? I mean, I know you're still producing.
Yeah, I'm actually working on a podcast.
Are you?
Yeah, well, trying to get one together. But I think it's a great medium, if it is a medium on its own. But I mean, that you can now you can basically produce an audio program with just a smartphone. You can record sound, edit, mix, and distribute just with a smartphone. That's amazing to me. I mean, when I started doing stories back in 83, it was kind of the beginning of that because I was able to buy a $300 tape recorder and a $150 microphone. And the engineers at NPR really kind of resented that because they were working with $6,000 Nagras and they'd been trained. So it was kind of, even then things were changing, but now it's just on a whole new level. That you can do everything, you know, theoretically with a smartphone. And it gives anybody the ability to it's not technically broadcasting, but it's kind of the same thing. You can produce a show and anybody in the world can listen to it. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Not only audio, but also video and text. Things are definitely different now, and I don't quite know how what's going to happen because of that, how the narrative forms are going to change. But I think undoubtedly things will change. It's just that we're kind of right in the beginning of it now.
Do you think that this is one of the questions I was asking Nick before, and I think Bill too. How has the internet, like the forms that you're seeing, videos, let me just mention in particular, what influence is that having for good or ill, like on people's attention spans, ability to capture narrative arcs, you know, take in stories? Because I know it's something you're worried about.
Well, the videos, most of the videos I see that go viral anyway, or the popular videos on YouTube, are just single shots without narration. And that looks to me like the first movies that were made back in 1895, 1900 by Thomas Edison, the Lumiere brothers. Just start the camera, film what's going on, and then turn it off. No narration. And so perhaps what we're seeing now is the start of new narrative form that's web-based. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so. I think that the web's always going to be like a place, it's a bulletin board for the forms that we already have, you know, film narrative, radio narrative, print narrative. And I, you know, if something else happens, if there's like this new way of telling stories that's just exclusively in the domain of the web or of the web, that would be great. But I don't know if I've seen it yet. They say that, you know, the multimedia stories like Snowfall by the New York Times, and then there was one about a wildfire in Tasmania by the Guardian. Very expensive work, lots of people working on it. It was audio, photographs, video, and text all mixed together with a table of contents. You could switch back and forth. I don't think that has much of a future because if the audience can stop the story and go somewhere else, then the author or the creator loses the emotional effects of the narrative arc. Like Shakespeare, my friend Larry was saying, it's like Shakespeare would never want the audience to click on and go somewhere else right in the middle of, you know, a soliloquy or something. Yeah. A narrative arc works because it puts people through a series of emotions, one after the other after the other, and in the end there's some resolution or something. If you lose them along the way, either they get bored or they, you know, look at something else and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so the web is good for, you know, being able to click back and forth and do all these different things. But as far as holding the attention of an audience through a story, I don't think it's going to be anything other than what we've, you know.
Forms we've got.
Yeah, radio, television, film.
Bill Lowry, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree with that. I just running through my head is, how do we make money doing any of this?
Yeah.
I mean, let's go back to the hard, cold reality. And I think when Nick was talking about, to me, I think that's probably right. Groups like Radiotopia getting together and being able to monetize. But when you have such small, fragmented audiences, you know, usually advertisers with big money to spend, they want mass. They want to get that message out there, in the widest spread possible.
Yep.
How do we make money doing these kinds of things? And the other thing is, you know, when anybody can do a podcast with a cell phone or a smartphone, when anybody can do a podcast, it's almost how do you make them special? Nick said he felt embarrassing for a long time. Well, I'm a podcaster. That's my job. Well, that's because, you know, I ran into a guy at a survival show this weekend and said, yeah, I just started doing a podcast about survivalism. You know, and anybody can do it in their garage, and there are millions of them. And how do you rise above all of that? And then how do you make money? Because I don't think anybody's really figured that out.
Nick, what do you think? Those are a lot of big questions there. How are you thinking about those?
Well, I think it's easy to make a podcast. It's not easy to make a podcast well.
Yeah. Nope.
And so I think if you focus on making something unique and high quality, it's actually not all that difficult to stand out. But yeah, I mean, we'll We'll see. I mean, I have no idea what the financial future of podcasting is going to be, but I think it's going to continue to grow. And I think the other thing is in terms of the relationship that people have with a podcast is different from radio. You know, I know one producer who does a show that started as a podcast, but it's now on a few stations, and his audience is about the same on the air as it is in podcasting. Mm-hmm. But when he does fundraisers, 90% of the money that he gets is from
the podcast.
Is from the podcast audience.
Yeah.
And I think the audience may be smaller, but I think that they're much more engaged.
I would agree with that. You know, I'm from the radio background for all of these many years, and I do a podcast, and my son, who produces the podcast, has to keep reminding me. He said, you know, this isn't a radio show. You don't have to keep saying who you're talking to.
Right.
You don't have to keep resetting the scene all the time. And I finally figured that out myself. I went,
A level of freedom there.
Yeah,
but
I can just talk to somebody.
We're running out of time, but Nick, that is the public radio model, right? I mean, when you have the fund drive, you have a fraction of the people who actually listen, who actually – they're the ones who are most engaged. They're the ones that are willing to pay for it, I suppose. And that's why podcasts – I guess that's what you feel hopeful about.
Yeah, and I think honestly that's why public radio podcasts have kind of dominated. I mean, you look at the top 10 in iTunes. I haven't looked at it recently, but I think it's like This American Life and Radiolab and a bunch of other – I think they're well suited to each other, that model.
We're about out of time. Scott, you wanted to say something?
I just want to say good luck, Nick, for you and people at Radiotopia.
I'm so excited that you are doing a podcast, actually.
So am I.
I'm working on
it. Soon. I'm
going to try and get it. I'm to actually broadcast it on our commercial radio show.
Nick Vanderkolk, he's the creator and producer of the podcast Love and Radio, joined us from member station WCVE in Richmond, Virginia. Nick, thanks a lot and good luck.
Thank you for having me.
Like Scott said, Scott Carrier, longtime radio producer, professor of journalism at Utah Valley University. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
And of course, Bill Allred, co-host of Radio from Hell on X96. Bill, thanks.
Thank you, Doug.
Cheers. This week on Video West, we're premiering a new short documentary that looks at another niche of radio, AM talk radio, a portrait of Utah's K-Talk, 6:30 AM, third oldest talk radio station in the country. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.